Okay, good morning to all of you, and we are going to begin our session this morning with the fourth sugya of Perek Gimel in Kiddushin. We're going to review for just a moment the Mishnah at the beginning of the Perek, which is the basis for the sugya that we're going to be learning. If you recall, the Mishnah, which appears in the Vilna, on Daf Nun Ched Amud Bet, but also you can see it at the beginning of your Perek of Rifadim sheets. The Mishnah brings us three cases, and they are in increasing order of complexity. Case number one, Ha'omer l'chaviro, Tzeva kadesh li'isha plonit, v'halach t'kitsha le'atzmo, mekudeshet l'asheni. That an individual who accepts shlichut to be Makadesh, a woman for someone else, and he goes and is Makadesh for himself, he indeed acquires the Kiddushin. The second case, V'chein ha'omer la'isha ha'reya mikudeshali, de'achar shloshim yom, uba acher v'kitsha betoch shloshim yom, mikudeshet la'sheni, bat Yisrael la'kohen tocha b'truma. That in the second case, the Kiddushin is not derech shaliach, but rather it's a delayed reaction. That rather the man says to the woman, you're mikudeshet to me in another 30 days, and then in the course of those 30 days, another individual comes and is mikadesher immediately, then the second individual receives the kiddushin. And that's the meaning of the word v'chein in the Mishnah, connecting case one and case two. Then in each of these cases, the woman is mikudeshet lasheni. If the third case is much more complicated, if the third case says, Me'achshav uli'achar shloshim yom, a man says to a woman, you are mikudeshet to me from now and after 30 days. Uba'acher v'kitsha betoch shloshim yom, and if another man comes and is mekadesher in the course of the 30 days, and his intention is for immediate kiddushin, then mikudeshet ve'ina mikudeshet. She's doubtfully mikudeshet to both of them. Why? Because in the formulation that the first man said to her, Me'achshav uli'achar shloshim yom, we have a doubt what his intention is. Is his intention that the Kiddushin is effective now, or is his intention that the Kiddushin is effective in 30 days? And this implies different things. It impacts directly on the effectiveness of the Kiddushin of the second man, who comes to be Mekadesher during the period in question. And therefore, since it is in doubt, the Mishnah concludes, "Bat Yisrael Kohen, Bat Kohen Yisrael Lo Tochal B'Truma." That we're machmir on the woman from both sides, whether she's a Bat Kohen who had the right to eat truma, now she does not because she's doubtfully mikudeshet to a Yisrael, or a Bat Yisrael that is doubtfully mikudeshet now to a Kohen, we're going to prevent her from eating truma as well because we're not sure of the status of this kiddushin. So we have three cases in the Mishnah in increasing levels of complexity. Now, if we turn to the sugya of the Gemara, which is on Daf Nuted Amud Bet, or in your Rivadim sheets, the Mishnah Mikudeshet Lasheni, which is likely dealing with the second case of our Mishnah, is quoted, and then on that we have a machloket between Rav and Shmuel, Mr. Brunson, as far as the source sheet is concerned, if you don't have the Rivadim source sheet from Torah in Motion as of yet, then best just to open up a Gemara to Kiddushin Daf Nun Ted Amud Bet, and then during the week, please write an email to Torah in Motion and have them send you the Rivadim sheets for the Perek that were distributed at the beginning of our sessions several weeks ago. Okay, in the beginning of our Gemara, we have a Machloket Rav and Shmuel. We have Amar Rav, Mikudeshet Lasheni Leolam. Ushmuel Amar, Mikudeshet Lasheni Ad Shloshim Yom. Now, notice the formulation, first of all, of the Memrot. We're dealing here with a Memra of Rav and a Memra of Shmuel, but they are put together in the classic form of argument. That is, Amar Rav, and then Shmuel Amar. With the Amar preceding the first opinion and following the name of the second opinion. This is the classic formulation for an argument. And Rav is saying that in this case, the kiddushin to the second individual, that is the one who is makadisher in the course of the 30 days, is permanent and will last forever. And Shmuel says that the kiddushin to the second individual is only good until 30 days. The Gemara, the Stamid Gemara, then fills in the remark of Shmuel and adds to it, Le'achar shloshim yom pak'e kiddushe sheni v'gamre kiddushe rishon. That at the end of the 30 days, the kiddushin of the second man who intervened during the 30 days evaporates into thin air, and the kiddushin of the first individual take effect. In other words, when he said, Hareat mikudesha li le'achar shloshim yom, then it means that in 30 days, she becomes mikudesha to him. And since that tanai was accepted by her before she accepted kiddushin from the second man, then the second man's kiddushin can only be effective as long as the tanai of the first man is not fulfilled. But the tanai, as soon as it is fulfilled on the 30th day, then the kiddushin of the first take hold, which immediately precede the kiddushin of the second. So this is the argument between Rav and Shmuel in the first generation in Bavel. And then the Gemara brings us from the third generation, from two generations later, it brings us a very interesting story. It tells us, Yatev Rav Chisda, Rav Chisda was sitting in the Beit Midrash, Vika Kashiade, and it was and he was having a difficulty with this statement of Shmuel, Kiddushe Sheni B'mai Pake. How can the Kiddushin of the second man evaporate into thin air? What logic is there in that? The minute the second man was Makadish this woman, and she was single at the time he was Makadisher, and his Kiddushin that he offered her were accepted by her, and therefore became effective, they can never just evaporate into thin air. Kiddushin, once established, can only be eliminated by the death of the Makadish or his giving of a get. And how can it just stop as if it never began? So Rav Chisda is having a very difficult time understanding what Shmuel is saying. And again, this is in the third generation, where he's reflecting on the statement of the first generation. And then comes Rav Yosef, who's the same generation as Rav Chisda, and they're very close in age. And suddenly now, Rav Yosef says to Rav Chisda as follows, Mor aresha matnila v'kashiale. Rav Yehuda asefa matnila velo kashiale. Rav Yosef comes to Rav Chisda and he says to him, look, the reason why you're having difficulty understanding what Shmuel is saying is because you are learning the statements of Rav and Shmuel with reference to case number 2 in the Mishnah. With case number 2. And in case number 2, when it says that a man says to a woman, Harea mekudeshet li le'achar shloshim yom, that is, the kiddushin will not be effective until the end, until the 30th day, and another man is mekadeshar during the 30 days, then clearly she's going to be mekudesha to the second man, and that kiddushin is going to be permanent, and therefore you have a lot of trouble understanding why Shmuel could possibly hold that the kiddushin of the second man will just evaporate after 30 days. But in our yeshiva, that is, in Pumbedita, Rav Yosef is saying, Rav Yehuda, who is Rav Yehuda bar Yecheskel, the Rosh Yeshiva Pumbedita, in the second generation and the personal teacher and Rebbe of Rav Yosef. Rav Yosef says, Rav Yehuda learned this machloket of Rav and Shmuel not on the second case, but on the third case. And therefore, he doesn't have any problem whatsoever understanding this machloket. Because when it says, Me'achshav uli'achar shloshim yom, that in the third case, the man says to the woman, Hareat mikudeshali, from now, from this point in time, and after 30 days, then Rav says, Mikudeshet veina mikudeshet le'olam. That when Rav said le'olam, he was referring to the doubtful state of the woman as being mikudeshet both to man number one and to man number two. And that this doubtful state goes on forever. And there's no time that it can ever be resolved. Where Shmuel comes and says, no, mikudeshet veina mikudeshet ela at shloshim yom. That the only time that we have a doubt about her status is in the first 30 days, before the first man's kiddushin becomes effective. Because when that happens, then the Kiddushin of the second man can evaporate, because what has happened here is that the Kiddushin of the first man, when he says Me'achshav u'le'achar shloshim yom, his intention is that in another 30 days the woman will be Mekadesha to him from now, from this point in time. And this point in time, day number one, retroactively becomes the effective date of the Kiddushin, and therefore it precedes the Kiddushin of man number two, which now retroactively could never have taken place, because the Kiddushin of man number one has taken place on day one. And this is what the Gemara then explains. It says, L'rav misapkale itana'a havai, ichazara havai. L'shmuel pshitale itana'a havai. That Rav was doubtful whether or not when a man says, Me'achshav uli'achar shloshim yom, from now and in another 30 days, whether what he's saying is a tanai, that is, tanai meaning that as long as in 30 days everything is the way it is now, everything is copacetic, then the Kiddushin will be effective retroactively to day one. And therefore any intervening Kiddushin that would come during the 30 days becomes completely eliminated. But Shmuel doesn't, as opposed to Chazara. Chazara means that when the man says, Harei mekudeshali me'achshav u'le'achar shloshim yom, he means, no, not now, not me'achshav, really in another 30 days. Where it's not a tnai that makes a retroactive kiddushin to day one, but rather, there's no kiddushin until day 30. That's, Rav has this doubt, whether it's a tnai or whether it's a chazara. And because Rav has this doubt, then her status as a safek mekudeshet, mekudeshet v'ina mekudeshet, goes on forever, because there's no way to resolve what the intention of the Mekadesh number one intended. But Shmuel doesn't have this doubt. Shmuel, it's obvious to Shmuel that it's a tanai, and that when he says to her at the day one, Me'achshav u'le'achar shloshim yom, that when the 30th day comes and everything remains as it is, the Kiddushin will be effective retroactively to day one, which would immediately precede and eliminate the possibility of any intervening Kiddushin. And therefore, this Kiddushin of man number two would evaporate, and the Kiddushin of man number one would take effect retroactively to day one. And therefore, what we have at this first component of the Sugya, we have a Machloket Rav and Shmuel, and then we have a discussion between Rav Chista and Rav Yosef from the third generation, exactly what Rav and Shmuel are talking about. Now, as we have seen in the sugya before this, the sugya of the machloket between Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish about whether or not dibur mevatel dibur or mevatel or not mevatel dibur, chozeret or ina chozeret, we saw that there was in the end two versions of the machloket of Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish. One version held that the machloket was relevant to our Mishnah, the first Mishnah of Perigimel, whereas others held, specifically the version brought by Rav Sfid, that the Machloket is not dealing with our Mishnah in Perek Gimel, but rather with a Mishnah in Perek Dalet, and that the tradition as it was brought from Eretz Yisrael was brought in two separate ways. Now here, in our sugya, we have something similar, because we have a Machloket Rav and Shmuel from the first generation, and yet we have a doubt among the Amoraim of generation number three to what Rav and Shmuel were relating. Were they relating to case number two in our Mishnah, or to case number three? And this difference, of course, has major implications for the sugya as a whole. Now, Rav Chista was a student of Rav Huna, who was a student of Rav. Rav Chista was the Rosh Yeshiva in Sura in the third generation, two generations after Rav. He probably knew Rav. He probably met him in his youth. And therefore, you would have thought that Rav Chista would have a fairly clear recollection of what it was that Rav was talking about. And therefore, he would understand Rav's position, but he would say, with Shmuel, how is it possible that Shmuel says what he says, that the Kiddushin of the second man are eliminated when the Kiddushin of the first man kick in on the 30th day? Rav Chista would be able to understand Rav's opinion, but would have difficulty understanding Shmuel's. Comes Rav Yosef, and he says, no, Rav Chista, Bemet, the reason why you have a problem understanding Shmuel is you've got this entire thing wrong. Rav and Shmuel were not talking about case two, they were talking about case three. And since they're talking about case three, we can understand the Machloket Rav and Shmuel is referring to whether or not the formulation of man number one, me'achshav u'le'achar shloshim yom, is a formulation of condition or formulation of retraction. And therefore, Rav Yehuda had a way to learn this machloket Rav and Shmuel so that it works very well for both of them on our Mishnah. Okay, so also here in this sugya, we have a doubt among the Amoraim themselves to what an earlier Amoraic dispute is referring, and that impacts on the way they understand the concepts, the halacha concepts in the sugya. Are there any questions about this first component from anyone, either through the chat writing or through the through speaking? Any questions from anyone? Just press down your transmit button and speak into your microphone. No questions of any kind? Okay, then we'll proceed. Now, what we're going to do, of course, is we're going to skip the Stam de Gemara, as we've learned to do in our previous sessions, and we'll come back to it later, after we finish learning the Amoraic Sugya. So what is the next Amoraic component? So as we scroll down in the Sugya on the Rivadim sheets, or as you take a look through the Sugya in the Vilna, now we're on Nuntet Amudbet, we find that the next Amora speaking is Abaye, Amar Abaye. Now who is Abaye? Abaye is a fourth generation Babylonian Amora. He was in Pumbedita. So in other words, the fact that Rav Yosef, who was from Pumbedita, says to Rav Chista what he says, Rav Yosef is really opening up the beginning of a Pumbeditan sugya here. We started with Rav and Surah and Shmuel and Nehar De'ah, and then we went to Pumbedita in generation 3, and now we are in Pumbedita generation 4. Now just a little background information on Abaye. Abaye was son of Rabbah's brother, and when he was Rabbah's nephew, and when his mother was pregnant with him, with Abaye, his father passed away, and then at childbirth his mother passed away, so he was born an orphan, and Abaye was then adopted by Rabbah Bar Nachmani, who was at that time the Rosh Yeshiva of Pumbedita. And his second in command was Rav Yosef, who was mentioned just earlier in the sugya. So it's very calm. Now what happened was Rabbah Bar Nachmani was Rosh Yeshiva in Pumbedita for 22 years. And when he passed away, Rav Yosef took over for him for 2.5 years. And when he passed away, Abaye became Rosh Yeshiva. So in a sugya like ours, where you have Abaye relating to what was said before, typically to Rav Yosef, it would appear that it's coming from those 2.5 years when Abaye is learning before Rav Yosef, after his adopted father, Rabbah Bar Nachmani, had passed away. Now, what is Abaye contributing here? Abaye says that Va echad ve'amarla harea mekudeshet li le'achar shloshim yom me'achshav u'le'achar shloshim yom. Uba acher v'yamar la harea mekudeshli me'achshav u'le'achar 20 yom. Uba acher v'yamar la harea mekudeshli me'achshav u'le'achar 10 yamim. Me'rishon u'me'acharon tzricha get. Me'emtzai eina tzricha get. Abaye is taking the position that Rav took, which is that we don't know whether or not the statement me'achshav u'le'achar 30 yom is a tnai or is a retraction. And we can say, well, if we have those two possibilities, it's either a tanai or it's a retraction, then if it's a tanai and everything goes well, then when would the kiddushin of the Rishon be effective? From day one. And if it's a chazara, if it's a retraction, and he's saying, me'achshav, no, the achar shloshim yom, then when would the kiddushin be effective? They'd be effective from day 30. And therefore, if we have a situation where one man uses this formulation, me'achshav u'le'achar shloshim yom, and another man uses the formulation, but he's only referring to 20 days forward, and the next doing with only 10 days forward, then what exactly do we have here? If the man who says, me'achshav u'le'achar asara yamim, is referring to a chazorah, to a retraction, then when he says, no, 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 not from now, but in another 10 days, then in reality, his kiddushin will be the first one to take effect of the three. On the other hand, if we say that it's a tanai, then what will happen is, no matter who comes in the middle, the fact that the first man says, me'achshav u'le'achar shloshim yom, and when that 30 day comes, it is good retroactively to day one, and immediately uproots all the intervening sets of kiddushin that can't come in the middle. And so therefore Abaye says, according to what Rav is doubtful whether or not it's Tanai or it's Chazorah, that if I had three men or any amount of men being Mekadesh the woman at different intervals of time, and then she would only require a get from the first and from the last. From the first, because his Kedushin, once they are Chal, once they become effective, retroactively work from the beginning of the period, and he was the first one to say Kedushin, so he will be the one to merit those Kedushin. Or, if you say that it's a Chazorah, that it's a retraction, then the one who will be Zocheh to the Kedushin will be the last one mentioned, who has the shortest period of time before the Kedushin becomes effective. So it turns out that, or from the first and from the last, she requires Gittin in order to be released from this troubling relationship, but she does not require from the middle one or any others that are in the middle, because according to them, they have others who precede them either as Tanai or as Chazorah. So what is it actually Abaye adding to this entire discussion? Abaye is saying that according to Rav's opinion, we would never require, in a series of individuals who are Mekadesh the same woman, we would never require a get from anyone more than the first and from the last. Okay, up till now, is this clear to everyone, what Abaye is saying? Please write your messages in the chat box or press down your transmit button to ask a question or to make a comment. So Eitan Diamond is asking, what about the issue of being married to multiple men? Well, indeed, that would appear to be an issue, but what Abaye is saying is that she's not married to multiple men. Because, let's analyze this. If you chart out on a piece of paper that one man is Mekadesher today, after that it should become effective after 30 days, the second man says he's Mekadesher now, but maybe it'll become effective in 20 days, and the other says after 10 days, then what we have is a kind of piling on of one on top of the other, where the only ones that could possibly be effective, according to Rav, are the one who says either Tanai, the one who says Chazorah. The one who claims, according to that which we say that it's a Tanai, then the first one who is Mekadesher will always be the first one whose condition will be effective, and therefore he will have to have a get. But if we say it's a retraction, then the only one that could possibly give a get is the one who is Mekadesher earliest, which is the one at 10 days. So she's not married to multiple men. She's at the most married to one. But we just don't know which one. Is she married to number one, or is she married to number three? She can't possibly be married to number two, because he's preceded by number one. He's preceded by number one if it's a Tanai, and he's preceded by number three if it's a Chazorah. Now, Bob in New York is asking, is this Rabba Bar Nachmani or Rava Bar Nachmani? Rabba with a bet. Resh, bet, hey. Rava, there is no Rabba Bar Nachmani to the best of my knowledge. Rava is the younger friend of Abaye, who was Rosh Hashiva in Mechoza after the 14 years of Abaye's reign in Pumbedita as Rosh Hashiva. And he's Rava Bar Yosef, not Rava Bar Nachman, Bar Nachmani. Okay. So this is what Abaye is contributing to our sugya. So how many layers do we have in the sugya so far, would you say? How many layers? That's why we're all here. Meeting is about the layers in the Gemara. So how many layers do we have so far? We haven't learned the sum of the Gemara. We'll leave that aside. How many Amoraic layers do we have? Please respond with a number on your chat or by pressing down your transmit button and speaking into your microphone. How many layers? Mm-hmm. Yes, Eitan says three. That is correct. We have three layers. We have layer generation one, Rav and Shmuel. We have the second layer, which is coming from generation three of Rav Chista and Rav Yosef. And we have the third layer, which is Abaye, in the fourth generation of Pumbedita. Very good. Now let's move on. After Abaye, who is the next Amora who appears? We have Ula. Ula, Amar Rabbi Yochanan, this is in component number 10, for those of you that have the Rivadim sheets, and those of you that do not have the Rivadim sheets, then you just have to slide along in the Sugya, in the Vilna, until you get to Ula. And Ula will be on the top of Daf Samech Amud Aleph, approximately 8 lines from the top. And Ula's coming, and Ula was the first great Nachota, the first great scholar who descended from Eretz Yisrael to Bavel, bringing Torah Eretz Yisrael with him. Okay, and and when he brought Torah Eretz Yisrael with him, he brought mostly Torah Rabbi Yochanan, although he's also very commonly bringing the Torah of Rabbi Elazar ben Fadat. In any event, we have here Ula, who comes and says in the name of Rabbi Yochanan, Afilu mea tofsimba. And then we have another tradition brought in the name of Rabbi Yochanan by his Talmid Rabbi Asi, who also says Afilu mea tofsimba. Now, what does this mean? That even 100 men can, as it were, have kiddushin, which is effective in this woman. He's coming, as you can see, in contradiction to what Abaye said, which is that at the most you can have Tfisat Kiddushin by the first or by the last, because either it's a Tanai or it's Chazara. But comes Rabbi Yochanan, as reported by Ula and by Rabbi Asi, and says, not so, that you can have even 100 men that can end up being Mekadesh, the same woman. Now, how can this possibly work? So if you take a look at the next component, which is Rav Misharshia, Berei de Rav Ami, the Rabbi Asi, who Rav Misharshia, who is the next generation, he says to Rav Asi, Asbaralach Ta'ama de Rabbi Yochanan, let me explain to you the Svara of Rabbi Yochanan. Shavu nafshai kishraga de livne techol chad vechad revacha lechavre shavak. That really these multiple individuals, as filu 100, are like bricklaying. The way that bricks are laid one on top of the other, but each one leaves a little space for the one beneath it and the one above it, because the bricks are not overlaid one exactly on top of the other, but rather they're laid in a format to allow space of each layer of brick before the other. Then these men are making themselves like a wall of bricks. Each one leaves a space for the other. Each one leaves a time allotment, which can be used by the others for the sake of Kiddushin with this woman. So what is actually happening? He'll say that if you have a whole series of individuals, that they can basically all be Mikudesha to the same woman at this time. And if you look in Rashi, Rashi explains this. He says, HaMesader Leveinim VeRuchav Kulan Shaveh Eino Mesader Mamash Zualzu Dimken Harei Shura Chitzona Nofelet VeChavrta Acharea Ela Mesader Tchila Zu Eitzel Zu VeChozer Mesader Aleha Shura Acheret VeNotena Chitzona Meshucha Lachutz Kedei Sheyishaer Revach B'Tachtona Leot Shnia Yoshevet Miktzat Aleha O Miktzat Al Sheetzla VeNishar Revach Gam B'Shnia Leot Shlishit Miktzat Aleha VeChen Kulam Hachina Mikol Echad Matza makom zman panui the kiddushin the tafsukulan the osra, that each one, as it were, found a certain spot in time when the woman would have been not yet mikudeshet, and each one has kiddushin at the time that they have reserved, and so therefore you can actually have a woman who is mikudeshet to many men now, but she's not mikudeshet simultaneously to many men. She's Mikudeshet to each one entirely at the time that divides between his initiated Kiddushin and the initiated Kiddushin of he who comes after him. So it's really, we have here a machloket, Abaye and Rabbi Yochanan, that is, Bavel and Eretz Yisrael, about whether or not the kiddushin, multiple kiddushin, gang kiddushin, I suppose we could call it, is effective or not effective. And on this we have the explanation of Rav Misharshev, Rei Rav Ami, that it's like a row of bricks, where the way you lay them one on top of the other, each one you leave a space for the one next to it to have a little bit of space on its own. Another one comes on top of it like that and like this, etc., etc. Okay, now on this we have the objection of Rav Hanina in component number 13. And Rav Hanina is a third generation Babylonian Amora, and he objects by bringing the following Tanaitic source. He says, Nehayom uleachar mita, get ve'eino get, ve'imet choletzet ve'lo mityabemet. That if a man says to a woman, this is your get, today, from today, and after my death, what does he mean? Does he mean it's a get which is effective today, after I die, it's retroactively effective now, the day I'm giving it to you? Or is he saying that it's only effective when I die? And the Mishnah says it's get vein o get. It's a doubtful get. We don't know whether or not she's migureshet or not. If it's a tanai, and the minute he dies she's retroactively migureshet from the day the get was given to her, that's fine. But if not, if it's hazara, if it's considered to be a retraction, then the woman is only becoming migureshet after the man has died. And that's something which is impossible, because after a man dies, he can have no more connections of ishut with a woman to be magarish her. So, and if the man dies, then choletet velo mityabemet, we don't allow her to be mityaben to either to anyone, because we're doubtful whether she's married or not. And therefore, she has to do chalitza on the brother of the deceased. This is Rav Hanina's question. Now, Rava, who's in the fourth generation, comes to answer Rav Hanina's remark, and he says, get lehutzi umita lehutzi. Ma shishir get gmarto mita. He says, why do you say that it's that this is problematic? So what you have is get comes to take the woman out from the man's control, and so does his death do the same. When the man dies, the woman leaves his sphere of control and becomes an independent personality again. So he says, whatever it is that the get has left over, death finishes. So he's saying that when a man says, Harezik itech me'achshav uliachar she'amut, yom moti, then what he's saying is, the get is effective now, that is in part, the process of the gerushin has begun, and then when we get to the day of his death, the death completes whatever the actual get has not completed. So Rava is basically responding to this quotation of Rabbi Hanina, that mehayom uleachar mita get veino get vimet choletet velo mityabemet, and Rava is saying that the get and the death of the Megaresh work in tandem to create a full break between them. Comes Abaye, and Abaye says to Rava, Midame, how can you compare the get and the death? Because get mutziyah mirishut yavam, when a man gives a get to his wife, then he's saying to her, you're migureshet, she has no moment where she leaves the authority of the husband who's dying now and goes into the authority of the yavam, because she's migureshet from him, from the first man, and she's not a widow. But the death of the man, machnisah l'rishut yavam, it has exactly the opposite effect, because instead of divorcing her from the first man, making her relationship with the brother-in-law asur, the mitah actually creates a bond between her and the brother-in-law upon the death of her husband, which enables her to become actually a protectorate of the yavam and eventually his wife. So you can't say that the death concludes an action that the get has begun, because the get and the death have completely opposite effects. Ela amar Abaye. So Abaye must correct what he said before. Not that the get begins the process and the death concludes it, but rather, Gzera mishum mehayom imati hareze get. That he says that in our case, the reason why in our case it's not going to work is because of a gzera that was made against the case where a man would say to a woman, mehayom imati hareze get. That today, if I die, it's a get. Because in that case, then we have a real problem, and because we would assume that there, it's not the get cannot possibly be good, that we'll say that there was a gzerah that was made by Chazal in order to prevent a person from coming to say mehayom imati by saying by also forbidding him to say meachshav uleachar shloshim yom, that even though meachshav may be good, we don't allow it because it's too similar to hayom imati, which we want to prevent. And this leads us then to the end of the Amoreik Sugya, where we have a disagreement between Rava and Abaye about the applicability of the suggestion that get begins and death completes it. So when we take a look at this, we see about the structure of the Sugya. Let's relate now to the structure of the Amoreik Sugya. Having learned the content a little bit, we learned before that there were three layers in the first part of the sugya. We have the first generational layer of Rav and Shmuel, the second generational layer, which consists of Rav Kista and Rav Yosef. We have the third generational layer, which consists of Abaye. And then we have an interruption of the Babylonian sugya for an actual quotation of a sugya from Eretz Yisrael, which is brought down by Ula in the name of Rabbi Yochanan, and then Rabbi Asi in the name of Rabbi Yochanan, and then Rav Misharshia Bereda Rav Ami says to Rav, all of these are Eretz Yisrael Dika Amoraim, and they're brought here as part of a unit which was brought down by Ula when he came to with a discussion about this from Eretz Yisrael to Pumbedita. So this Israeli piece of Amoraic material is dividing between two Babylonian pieces. The first is the expression of Shmuel about get, which is, and then we have after that, we have the second part of the sugya, of the Babylonian sugya, which is brought after the Israeli piece, which deals with Rava and Abaye's discussion about get and mavet. So we have two components from Babylonia and one from Eretz Israel in the middle. And what I'd like to ask you is, why do you think the sugya is designed this way? Why don't we just have all of the Babylonian material on the one hand, and then the Eretz Yisraelic material should be brought at the end? Why is it brought in the middle between the two Babylonian components? Who would like to weigh in on this question? Either in writing or by speaking by pressing your transmit button. Eitan, what do you have to say? Jeff from New Jersey, you've been quiet this time. Please share with us your thoughts. Who would like to suggest why the sugya is built this way? So Eitan is suggesting to make the transition between marriage and divorce. Yes, that's a very nice suggestion. That is, if you take a look at the first, very first part of the sugya, the first components are dealing clearly with marriage. They're dealing with Kiddushin. But if you look at Ula, who is also dealing with Kiddushin, but what happens is that they're dealing with Kiddushin, but they're dealing with the concept of multiple Kiddushin, even by 100. And this to differentiate them from what Abaye said before, that Kiddushin can only be effective from the first or from the last man. So and then afterwards, when we get to Mativ Rav Chanina, the second component of the sugya is dealing only with divorce. So what Eitan is suggesting from Toronto is that really it's not one Babylonian sugya. It's two Babylonian sugyas. It's one Babylonian sugya that deals with marriage at the beginning, that was in the first and the third generation, and then we have a Babylonian sugya that deals with the implications of the first sugya on the issue of divorce. And that is brought in the last component of the Babylonian sugya. And in the middle, we have the statements of the Eretz Yisrael Tekam Moraim, which are relating to Kiddushin, which is the first Babylonian component. Now, to round out Eitan's answer, which I think is correct, we need to understand that how is material brought from Eretz Yisrael to Bavel? How is it brought? So I've explained that it's being brought by Ula, who is a Nachota, and you probably know, some of you, the names of the other Nachotai who came from Eretz Yisrael and brought material to Bavel, and they are Ravin and Ravdimi, who come in the fourth generation. Now, when these Nachotai come, where exactly do they come to and when? So if you look at any map of the Middle East, you'll see that the Nachotai who came from Eretz Yisrael to Bavel did not come directly from west to east across the desert. They couldn't do that because of the conditions. They had to travel north from Eretz Yisrael into Lebanon. This is called the Sulamah Shel Tzor. They would go up this the Tzor ladder, as it were, to the mountains of Lebanon, and then find their way up to the beginning of the tributaries of the Euphrates River, which is approximately where Haran is, where Terach and Avram stopped on their way from Ur Kasdim to Eretz Yisrael. And then, following the Euphrates River, they would find their way down into Mesopotamia, into Bavel. Which yeshiva would they hit first? Sura or Pumbedita? They would hit Pumbedita first, because Pumbedita was a more northern academy. And therefore, the Torah of Eretz Yisrael that is being imported into Bavel from Eretz Yisrael is generally collected first in Pumbedita before Sura. And that's why what you have at the beginning of the sugya, where you have Rav Chista troubled by something, and Rav Yosef in Pumbedita responds and says, well, the only reason you're having trouble is because you're learning it the way you are, but if you would learn it on the third case, as we do here in Pumbedita, like Rav Yehuda has instructed us, then you would have no problem. And therefore, once he says that, and Abaye in the fourth generation makes his remark that in any event you could only have a requirement of get from case 1 or case 3, but not from case 2, that summarizes, from a Babylonian point of view, what the Machloket in Rav and Shmuel is about. And that is the appropriate time to insert the material that's now been received from Eretz Yisrael in the fourth generation in the Pumbeditan station, where it comes down in, and here it's it's installed. And only after that do we have then a second component of Babylonian material, which starts with a question of Rabbi Hanina about the implications of the sugya for the issues of divorce, and Rava and Abaye's discussion of it. So it's a little bit misleading, because you see Abaye and Rava at the end of the sugya, you want to connect them to Abaye at the beginning of the sugya, but it's really not. It's really two completely separate discussions about the same topic. And the Eretz Yisrael material comes in the middle because it is responding to the issue of marriage, multiple marriage, which is brought up by Abaye at the end of the first Babylonian component. Is this clear? Now, if you'd like to read more about the way the Nechotai bring Torat Eretz Yisrael, you can read a wonderful book by Tzvi Dor Alav Shalom called Torat Eretz Yisrael B'Bavel. And he describes this process of how the Nechotai brought Torat Eretz Yisrael down to Bavel. And he also makes it very clear that in the second part of his book, that the main individuals who collected Torat Rabbi Yochanan as it came from Eretz Yisrael to Bavel were Abaye and Rava. And Rava, as a matter of fact, we know to have been probably the main editor of Torat Eretz Yisrael as it came to Bavel. So therefore, it's very common that we find Torat Eretz Yisrael filed in the sugya after either the third or the fourth, and generally the fourth generation in Pumbedita is the time when Torat Eretz Yisrael is inserted in the sugya. Not because it necessarily came then, but it was collected and formulated at that time, and therefore inserted in the sugya at that point. Okay, are there any questions about this process of transfer of Torat Eretz Yisrael to Bavel, about the Nachotai, and how that has affected our sugya? Any questions? No questions? Okay, so now let's take a look back at our sugya again, and let's see what are the functions of the stomach gemara in this sugya. Eitan, the name of the book is Torat Eretz Yisrael B'Bavel by Tzvi Dor. Tzvi Dor. If you're not able to find it there in the Great White North, you'll let me know. We can get it here in Eretz Yisrael and send it to you. Okay, let's go back to the very beginning of our sugya, and let's see what are the functions of the stomach as we go along. In component number two, when we had Shmuel's rather surprising statement that Mikudeshet Lashani at Shloshim Yom, the Stamah de Gemara, which adds in component 2 bet, Le'achar Shloshim Yom, Pak'e Kiddushe Shene, Begamre Kiddushe Rishon, what is the Stamah relating to? What is the Stamah trying to explain? Well, I don't hear you, any of you, but the sum is trying to alleviate an immediate difficulty that we have with Shmuel, which is, how is it, what happens to the condition of the second man? How does that disappear? And so, why is the Mikudeshet to the Sheni only for 30 days? Which is a very strange concept. And so the stomach comes to explain that why the condition of the second man are eliminated. It's because the first man who made Kiddushin for 30 days hence, when the 30 days is over, it's retroactively good before the second man, and therefore it predates him, precedes him, and eliminates him from the equation. So the purpose of the stomach here is what we call Pirush HaMemra. It's coming to explain the Memra of Shmuel. That's the first piece of Stamah de Gemara. The second piece of Stamah de Gemara can be found in component number 7 on your Rivadim sheets. In component number 7, we have an explanation again of the Svarot of Rav and Shmuel. And the stomach says, L'Rav misapkale itanai havai ichazorah havai, that Rav is doubtful whether this formulation of Me'achshav u'le'achar shloshim yom, whether it's conditional or whether it is a retraction. But l'Shmuel pshita le'itanai havai, but for Shmuel it's obvious that it's to be taken as a Tanai. So what are these two lines of Stamah doing? They're doing exactly what the first line of Stamah did earlier in 2 Bet. That is, they're doing what's called Pirush HaMemra. They're explaining the Svarot of the Amoraim. The Amoraim don't bring Svarot. They only bring their Psikot Halakha. But the Stamah de Gemara is bringing the Svarot behind the Psika of the Amoraim. And then we have an addition of the stomach, where the stomach adds ube plukta dahani tanai. Here, this formulation ube plukta the tanai, or just simply ube plukta, brought in many cases, is an attempt of the stomach de Gemara to align an amoreic machloket with a tanaitic machloket. Now, why would the stomach want to do this? Why is the stomach attempting to say that this machloket that appears among the amoraim is really a much earlier machloket that has appeared first among the Tanaim? This is what I term the principle of the stomach of limitation of dispute. The stomach is attempting to limit the number of disputes in the system. And the way you can do that is by saying what looks to you like an Amoraic dispute is not really an Amoraic dispute. It's a Tanaitic dispute. It started many, many years before. And all the Amoraim are doing is going in the shitot of the Tanaim that have already been established. So when it's uplukta dahani tanai, that when we have an ebraita machloket on the words mehayom uleachar mita, get ve'eino get divrei chachamim, ribi omer kaze get, then we have this machloket whether or not this is an effective get or not when he says mehayom uleachar mita. And the Gemara immediately suggests, if that's the case, name a Rav halacha karabanan, the name of Shmuel halacha karibi. Why do Rav and Shmuel interpret our Mishnah and say what they say about our Mishnah? They should not be relating to this at all. They should just be saying halacha is like the Chachamim in the Braita, or halacha is like Rabbi in the Braita, because the Shitot are not theirs. The Shitot originate from Rav and Shmuel, and they should simply be quoting those Shitot rather than restating them in their own names. And then, when the Gemara brings this formulation of a Bipukta, you know in advance that any time the Gemara wants to align an Amoraic argument with a Stama argument, the result must be no, the alignment can't work. Because if it could work, we'd have no need for the Amoraic argument in the first place. So the Stama says, Tzricha, no, I require the Amoraic Machloket, despite the presence of the Tanitic Machloket. Why? De'ilu amar rav halacha karavanan, hava amena hatam delurachuka ka'ate, avalhacha delikaruvaka ate, ema modele lishmuel de tanoi havai. Ve'i amar shmuel halacha kiribi, hava amena hatam hu te'ein get lechamita, avalhacha de'esh kidushin echarsh lushim, ema modele lirav, tzricha. That we have to demonstrate that both Rav and Shmuel can explain themselves according to both opinions in the Braita. Woman close to him with Kiddushin, that I would say that he holds like Shmuel that it's a Tanai, and that he means the Kiddushin to be effective as early as possible. And Shmuel, who says Halacha is like Revi, that's only because he holds that since there is Kiddushin after 30 days, you can say he's Moda to Rav. And therefore, because you'd be able to have Rav and Shmuel explain themselves, each according that orza the Chachamim in the Tandadik Machloket, we therefore require the Amoraic Machloket to see what exactly their shitot are. And therefore the Gemara concludes, b'fa'at tzricha. So here we have the Gemara using, is not doing pirusha memra, but the Gemara is doing, making use of a fixed argumentation pattern, for the sake of its discussion, for coming up with possible chidushim in the opinions of Rav and Shmuel, and the opinions of the Chachamim and Ribi in the Tanaitic dispute, so that we would not have an alignment of the Machlokot, but we would have two Machlokot that are really disparate one from the other. Okay. Now, as the Gemara goes on in component number 8 and component number 9, we have two more examples of the same functions that we've seen previously. In function number 8, where the Gemara says, Manashach, itana havai de kama kidushe de hanach lav kidushe, ichazara havai de batra kidushe de hanach lav kidushe, here what the Gemara is doing is it's explaining Abaye's memra. So we have another example of pirush hamemra. Whereas in component number 9, we have a tosefet of an addition of the stama by use of an argumentation pattern, where the Gemara says, pshita, what you're saying is obvious. He says, no, it's not obvious. Ma'u detema, hai lishna, mashma tana, u mashma chazara, the tibai gita mikochad vechad, kamashmalan. It's not obvious what Abaye is saying, because you might say that the language of me'achshav uliachar, or me'hayom uliachar, has within it both conditional elements and elements of retraction. And therefore you require a get from every single one of the men who were involved, kamash malan, that you won't. So this is also an argumentation pattern, pshita, ma'utatema, kamash malan, where the Gemara is giving you what's called the havamina and the maskana of the logic. Now, what we've tried to do here in this sugya is first analyze the Amoraic sugya into its three components, the Babylonian component number 1, Eretz Israel component, and Babylonian component number 2. And then an Eitan Diamond is asking, what does Kamash Malan mean? It means, therefore, we have the conclusion of why it is not, why it's not Pshita. It's not at all obvious what Abaye is saying. Kamash Malan, therefore, he comes to tell us, literally. And so we've not only attempted to organize the Amoraic Sugya into its three components, but we're also organizing the Stama according to its functions. There's Stama which is Perusha Memra, and there's Stama which is using argumentation patterns for the sake of analysis. And these functions of the Stama are consistent all the way through the Babylonian Talmud. By the way, we've also learned in this sugya about how the Nechotai worked, and how their Torah was collected when it arrived in Babel, as they came from north to south into Mesopotamia from Haran. So we've learned both method and content in this sugya, which is our goal in all of the lessons, to mix understanding of content with the learning of method. And I'm open now in our last 2-3 minutes of our meeting for any questions that you may want to ask about the things we've learned from this sugya today. Please ask either in the chat window, by writing, or by pressing on your transmit button and speaking into your microphone in order to ask your questions. Please. Who would like to ask the first question? While I'm waiting for your questions, I just want you all to know, those of you who are in Toronto, in New York, I know you're having difficult weather. When I came back to Eretz Israel on Thursday for my trip, you should just know that it's bright and sunny in Eretz Israel, beautiful weather, lots of rain, everything is green, but it's today, in the last few days, it's been sunny and warm, and I want you all to eat your hearts out and consider seriously coming to Eretz Israel where the weather is so beautiful. Are there any questions? So Eitan Diamond is asking, what is the best Aramaic dictionary to help with the language and phrases? Well, there are several Aramaic dictionaries. The first one that was published, as you know, was the one by Marcus Jastrow, which is not bad, but a little bit difficult to use. It's been superseded by two other dictionaries. One is the very highly academic and accurate dictionary of Sokolov from Bar-Ilan, called the Dictionary of Babylonian Jewish Aramaic, which is probably the best scientifically. But a popular dictionary, which is a good one to use, especially at the beginning of your study, is the one that was done by Ezra Tzion Melamed, Milon Arami Ivri. It was originally published as an Aramaic Hebrew dictionary. It was then republished by Feldheim as an Aramaic Hebrew English dictionary, a trilingual dictionary. And that is available in most bookstores in the United States and Canada, and I would recommend that you use that one at this stage, and then you can graduate into the Sokolov dictionary at a later date when you feel that you're ready for it. Another good thing about the dictionary of Ezra Tzion Melamed is that he has within it also grammar tables, so you're able to see how to decline an Aramaic noun, how to conjugate the Aramaic verbs, etc., which is also very useful. A companion volume of that would be the book Deikoname by Yaakov Frank, where he teaches Babylonian Aramaic grammar in a way that's understandable and designed for those who are initiating themselves in the reading of Gemara. Okay, well, that just about does it for today, ladies and gentlemen, and so I'll sign off from beautiful downtown Elkanah in the Shomron in Eretz Israel, and I look forward to seeing you all again at this time, same station, next Sunday, after we have our last observance of Tzom Asarah B'Tevet, before the Binyan Beit HaMikdash. So be well, all of you, and look forward to seeing you again next week. Kol Tuv.